I always appreciated games and puzzles and exercises where you took two very different things or people and showed how they were connected. And when I realized that I had done that in this sermon at the beginning, taking two very different people and connecting them and doing the same at the end, I began to think back about where I first heard this game, this skill, this sort of spiritual 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. And I started to remember that when I was a child, we used to take trips to my grandparents in Boston. And whether we drove from Harrisburg or Philadelphia, it was a 7-8 hour drive, and we would all pile into the green station wagon, which everyone had at the time, and had it been preserved, could be put right on the set of Mad Men today. And of course, there was no DVD in the back. There were hardly even seat belts. We all just sort of rolled around in the back of the car and no one thought anything about it. And my parents had to keep us entertained. The license plate game and the gas station game only went so far. By your 10th SO, you were bored. So we used to play 20 questions. You would give the initials AL, and then we would have 20 questions to figure out that it was Abraham Lincoln. I remember, by the way, the most successful attempt at this was when my younger brother, Danny, was 5 or 6 years old. And we let him play because you got to let the kid play. And he said EH, and we racked our brains and could not figure it out. And when we finally gave up with this look of triumphant glee, he said, Eliyahu Hanavi. But even that game wasn't quite enough. And what would happen sometimes is after we had named a couple of people, we would ask my father, who had a comprehensive knowledge of history and lots of other stuff, to connect them. And I wish I remembered more. I only remember one connection, but it'll show you, because I remember it, I'll tell it to you, it'll show you how the game sort of worked and how he worked. He also, by the way, had a nice taste in taluses. This was his. Several of you have asked me where I got such a colorful talus. Once my brother did Beethoven, and I had just finished a class in high school about the Dreyfus trial. So I did AD, which was Alfred Dreyfus. I don't even remember if we got Alfred Dreyfus or not. But then at the end, one of us said, okay, Dad, connect them. And he said, Beethoven's teacher was Haydn. Haydn's patron was named Esterhazy, Nicholas Esterhazy. And the man who really betrayed France, that Dreyfus was falsely accused for, was actually Ferdinand Esterhazy of the same family. You see what I grew up with? Go play Trivial Pursuit with this guy. So when I had these very different people to connect, I thought of this, and I want to tell you how they both came to me. The first came to me about a year ago, when a man walked into my office and told me that we've never met, although we know of each other, because we have almost the same name. Your name is David Wolpe, he said, and my name is David Wolper. And I am old and I am sick, and I want a rabbi who will be there to do my funeral. I knew of David Wolper, not only because once or twice I had been sent his prescriptions by the pharmacy, but because he was the producer of Roots, many other things, and as he told me, but what really matters is every single day of my life, someone comes up to me and says, you did Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I revisited the movie, and I remembered the character of Violet Beauregard. Violet Beauregard is this girl who's very greedy, as, by the way, are all the kids in the movie except for Charlie, which is why he ends up with the chocolate factory. And her greed is visually represented because she blows up like a blueberry. And the idea, of course, is that everything she takes in doesn't really enlarge her as a person. In fact, it makes her smaller. Later that year, because I was speaking in Boston, I took a pilgrimage to Concord and visited Emerson's Museum and Walden Pond. And there, I met the opposite of Violet Beauregard. His name was Henry Thoreau. He was an American writer and naturalist and wrote one of the most famous works in American history called Walden. He lived on Walden Pond, and he wrote there. And he said why he wrote there. I went to the woods, he said, because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, to see if I could learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover I had not lived. I didn't wish to live what was not life, life being so dear. I saw the replica of the cabin that he lived in Walden. It's maybe half the size of this Bema, maybe. It doesn't even deserve to be called a cabin. And what I was struck by in thinking of these two such different images is how one, by acquiring, made herself smaller, and the other, by divesting himself, made himself larger. Thoreau strides like a colossus across American history. If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. That phrase graces a million high school yearbooks. And I realized, we have an urge to be larger, all of us, but we don't all know how to do it. So we get a bigger house, but we don't get any larger. We rattle around in that house like a pea in a crock pot. It doesn't make us any bigger just because the house is big. Or we get a bigger car, but it doesn't matter how big your car is. There are only so many places to go. It doesn't matter how extensive your table. You can only eat so much. There is only one thing that will make you bigger, and that is you are made big by being used by a big idea. Not something you do, but something you allow to be done to you. Thoreau had a big idea. He wanted to learn how to live without stuff, and because he allowed himself to be used by that idea, he became immortal. Socrates did the same thing and was gripped by a similar idea about how to live and came to the same conclusion. When Socrates went to the market in Athens and he saw everything that was spread out, do you know what he said? He said, "It is amazing that there are so many things that human beings create that I do not want." To be great is to be used by a great idea. There was nothing historic about Herzl. Herzl was a man. He was a writer, like a lot of other writers at the time. Some of his plays were more successful, some were less successful. Nobody would have pointed to Theodor Herzl and said, "This man is going to make history." But he allowed himself to be used by a great idea. And he gave himself to it. And the more he gave himself to the idea, the larger he grew. In 1909, a woman who was almost 50 years old, who had done nothing unusual or extraordinary with her life, nothing, she visited what was then called Palestine. and she saw that the members of the yeshuv, of the Jewish settlement, had no health care. And she was seized by a great idea. And so she brought some women from America, some of her friends, to help her create a healthcare system for the poor Jews who had no one to watch out for them. And she set up an organization and she called it Hadassah. And she built a hospital and an institution, and now it has some 300,000 members, and Henrietta Zold became great by being used by a great idea. And she didn't do it for fame or for thanks, but because there is something magical and powerful and enlivening about the flow of something great moving through you. The self-forgetfulness that comes when you're doing something that you were designed to do, which is something important. At times, it allows you to do things that you otherwise could not do. This year, I read an article about someone whose name I had long known, but I never knew his story. From the time that I used to play tournament chess in high school, I knew the name Miguel Neidorf. He died about 15 years ago, a little less. He was a great Argentinian chess player. And Neidorf was known for many things. He had a very successful chess career. He beat most of the world champions at various times, though he never attained the championship himself. But there was one thing in particular that every chess player knows that Neidorf did. But I never knew why he did it. There is a strange variant of chess called blindfold chess. You don't literally put on a blindfold, but you play without looking at the board. Only a very good player can play a game of chess without looking at the board, because you have to keep the game in your head. Some exceptional players can play several games, 3, 4, 5, 10 games without looking at the board. That's only if they're among the best. Some of the very highest rank have been able to play 20 or 25 games without looking at the board simultaneously against different opponents. In 1947, to the astonishment of everybody who pays attention to such things, Miguel Neidorf played 45 opponents at once. Now, first of all, he won almost every game. He drew 4, I believe, and lost 2. All the rest, 39, he won. It took him 23 hours to play all 45 opponents one after another, and he never looked at any of the boards. He kept all 45 games in his head. It's a record that's never been approached. I don't know if it'll ever be broken. But I never knew why he did it. But this year, I discovered, and it's a very moving story. What I didn't know was he was not born Miguel Neidorf. He was born Mendel Mieczysław in Poland. And he was a Jew. And in 1939, he was invited to play in a tournament in Argentina. And he went. And a week later, while he was playing in the tournament, the Nazis invaded Poland. And he never saw his family again. He couldn't go back, and he couldn't get news. And he had no idea what became of his entire family. And after the war, between 1945 and 1947, he tried everything he could to get information, but no one knew where anyone was or where they had gone. And he racked his brains. What could he do if they were still alive to get them word that he was there? So he thought, I will do something that will make headlines all over the world, because that's the only way that if they're still alive, they'll know I'm here. So he trained himself to play more games of blindfold chess, because that was what he knew. And he did this extraordinary thing, but he did it not to be famous, not to pull a stunt, but because he was being used by ideas of love and of memory. Because he wanted something to work through him so that if someone was still alive, he would find them again. Didn't happen. Everyone was gone. But that service and that purpose left a legacy. Before I came here today, I was fortunate enough to take a look at our congregant Rick Richmond's Jewish Current Issues website, and there he has a short video that beautifully illustrates this idea. You know, between 1927 and 1947, the British controlled the city of Jerusalem and the Western Wall, and they allowed Jews to go to the Western Wall, but one thing they did not allow: you could not blow the shofar on Yom Kippur. Because that, they said, would incite the Arabs, and so they literally policed the wall and checked everybody to make sure they didn't have a shofar as they came to the wall. You know that between 1948 and 1967, no Jew was allowed at the wall at all. You couldn't approach at all, ever. But before that, you could, but you could not blow a shofar. And yet, every Ne'ilah between 1927 and 1947, every single year, some Jew snuck a shofar into the city, and every year, one or more people blew the shofar and were arrested, by the way. Some of them kept in jail for as long as 6 months for the crime of blowing the shofar. Now, why did they do it? Nobody became famous. In fact, who knew their names until this video, which reunited six or seven of them who are still alive, and they went to the wall and all blew the shofar together. Very moving and very beautiful. But first of all, they were hand-selected by a group of people in the city. One of them talks about how some Israelis came to him and said, you know, would you be interested? And he said, I wouldn't. They said, you know what, we actually don't want you because your parents will be worried about you, could get arrested. He said, it's okay, I have no parents. They were kids, they were children. The last man to blow the shofar at the Western Wall was named Abraham Eliakim. In 1947, as a 13-year-old kid, he snuck a shofar to the Western Wall, and he blew it the year before the state was declared and the city was taken away. In 1967, when the Jews retook the city of Jerusalem, Abraham Eliakim was in uniform as a soldier. And as soon as he could, he made his way to the wall. And there, he looked around to see if there was a Jew with a shofar anywhere. And sure enough, there was. And he said, please, I need to borrow your shofar. He gave it to him. And he began to blow for all he was worth. And an old man came up to him and said, so what's with the shofar? And Abraham said, I was the last man to blow the shofar at this wall in 1947. And the other man said, my name is Rabbi Siegel. I was the first in 1927. And they fell into each other's arms and they cried. Extraordinary, because they allowed themselves to be used by a great idea, by something powerful and important. I don't know that the shofar was blown by them. I think it was blown through them. That's what it means to allow yourself to be used, to grow bigger. And if you were here this Shabbat, then you know what I mean. Because this past Shabbat, I told you that at the beginning I was connecting two disparate people, Thoreau and Beauregard. I'm going to do it at the end. When you tell people that you can be great by being moved by an extraordinary idea, we tend to think of it as being someone else, someone not like us, someone not from our world. But this past Shabbat, if you were here, you heard Janice Kamener-Resnick, who grew up in this synagogue, whose father Ed Kaminer, president and builder of this synagogue, passed away this year, whose mother, Charlotte Kaminer, has been a communal worker not only at Sinai, but in Los Angeles for decades. And she talked about working, Janice, with Jewish World Watch. And she talked about going to the Congo and there meeting Renee, someone from another world. And Renee told her how the soldiers invaded her hut and killed her children and ruined her body. And Janice met her at Heal Africa Hospital, where she had had numerous surgeries to try to reconstruct what they had torn asunder. And Renee had two questions for Janice. She said, "Who are you and why are you here?" Janice also met Zanuba in Darfur, in the Sudan. Zanuba, whose children and parents were killed before her eyes by the Janjaweed militia, slaughtered and burned in a funeral pyre. And Zanuba asked her the same two questions. She said, "Who are you and why are you here?" And at first, Janice said, "I'm a Jew," but neither this Christian woman nor this Muslim woman had any idea what a Jew was. They hadn't had that education. They didn't know a Jew. So Janice said, "I'm from an ancient tribe of people. And we have an ancient belief that every human being is created in God's image. And every one of us has a spark of the divine. And we believe that we were given that spark to do good and righteousness in this world so that we can earn the right to be called God's partners. That's who I am." That's an idea that makes you grow. That's an idea not that you can use, but that can use you. Abraham was not the smartest man in the ancient world. He was not a philosopher. But God said to him, "Lech lecha, go, I need you. I need to use you." And even though he left with his father and they stopped in Haran, his father stayed there and lived a nice life. But Abraham became a blessing. A lot of us stay in Haran. But we would be better if we would be used. Our tradition has given us ideas that can use us. So this year, allow those ideas to live through you. Remember what God said to Abraham, "I will bless you, and you will be a blessing." In the year ahead, be blessed and be a blessing. Shana Tovah.